Blog Talk Radio.
This is Kevin Boileau. We're moving into more conversation about the general state of things. I'm here with Nazarita Goldhammer on the radio, and we're just continuing from last week about the general state of things. We've been involved in intense discussions for several months, and now we're just basically having a lighthearted conversation about things. I'd like to point out that we live in an absolutely beautiful world, the world of nature. But then if you juxtapose that with the human, we see how we taint and poison. That's not everybody, but it seems to be a general way in the world that humanity is destroying other humans. That means destroying itself, other species, the world. And it's really hard to walk away from that, to avoid that, to pretend that it's not there. And so we thought we'd have a little bit of conversation about the complacent, people who don't want to intervene, people who want to just sit on the sidelines, kind of keep the status quo. What are your thoughts on that, Nazarita? About people who aren't really doing anything to intervene, people who are just complacent, they it's just too frightening for them to change the status quo. What do you think?
Well, it depends on your status quo, right? So a lot of people who have a really what they consider a good life, they're not stopped by the police. They live in an area where there isn't a lot of crime. They bring in a lot of money. They can buy whatever they want. The status quo seems pretty good to them. And remember, if you're going against an oppression, if you're going against a law that is not fair, it means that you have consequences. Consequences are not only the good consequences of solidarity, but you also have repercussions of standing up for that which is right. And I think in everybody's heart, they understand that there are repercussions, and that means that they will have to have sacrifice. And it isn't always a bad thing, but it achieves the goal. And so that's what I think. I think there are a lot of complacent people because they feel that their lives are okay. It's only when it starts to affect someone's life that they begin to think, maybe this isn't so good. Maybe when they're stopped at the airport because they had a facial scan and they found them, they were stopped because they were on an FBI list, because they'd written an article when they were even 10 years ago about something that they were dissatisfied with, and they were stopped at the airport because a facial scan recognized that they had written this, and they were stopped and pulled over. That's when someone begins to think, wow, maybe the life I've been living in the comfort that I think is the epitome of a good life, maybe it's not so good. Maybe my freedom is at stake. And that's when
right,
people
but let me,
think,
let me
begin
interject.
To be.
Yeah, but let me jump in on that. So the thing is, I think that people are not, they don't perceive when they're affected. I think a lot of people are just unaware. And so they are negatively affected, but they don't get it. And they don't really get it until the Gestapo are at their door. That's kind of what I see. And I think that's what you're saying, is that people just, as long as they don't perceive that their immediate interests are being affected, they don't do anything. And so the,
right.
the
so,
motivation...
So remember?
Hello? Nazarita, are you still on the show?
I'm right here. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were on a roll.
Well, no,
so
I'm just saying we have this juxtaposition between the beauty of nature, which is fine if left alone. This is the thing. We don't have to do anything to it. It's doing fine on its own. But yet humanity is so screwed up and it's so dysfunctional that for the complacent people who don't want to intervene, they're usually people who make good money in corporations. They've got great governmental jobs, great pensions. And if they just keep their mouth shut, they get through life just fine. They have their little manicured lawn, their little Sunday barbecue, all their nice little friends, but they do absolutely nothing to intervene. That's what I'm getting at. How do we tie these two completely different thoughts together? One, the beauty of nature runs on its own just fine, and two, humanity doesn't run well on its own without everybody being involved and participating and intervening. We have what we have now. How do we make sense out of that?
So here's a couple questions. People are very stressed. They're stressed. They feel like their lives are overcomplicated, and so you have to start by asking yourself, we have a culture that is on the go all the time. It's filled with entertainment. It's filled with work. It's filled with all these things. But you have to ask yourself, why is life not simple? Why is life so stressful? And I want to bring up, this was a really great article written a long time ago. I think it was in the, believe it or not, 80s. It was by Michael Ventura called Someone is Stealing Your Life. And it was this expose on the way Americans work. And now, of course, it's bled into the rest of the world of you have this job and you work 9 to 5 and you work overtime and you have this little tiny space for entertainment. And then maybe nature plays a little bit of part, but then you have family obligations. You have to take care of the house and you have to take care of the kids and you have to shop and you have to do all these things. And so what is your life? And that's part of the wake-up call of maybe the pandemic interposed with this great outcry of police brutality and the way that we have these biases and isms toward other cultures. Back and forth. I mean, I don't think anybody is exempt from this. It's very, very hard to find someone that is colorblind on any of the sides. It's really hard. And so, how do we change that? How do we link with nature? One, I really think that we have to look at what is our busyness that stops us from interfering when we see something unjust, because it's going to take our time. We know if we interfere in something that we see is unjust, you can bet you're going to be there a while, because you're going to have to be interviewed, you're going to have to stand up for somebody, you're going to have to talk. And so I think a lot of times people think that. They think, oh, I don't have time. I don't have time to help that person. I don't have time to intervene. And my last thought, and here it is that, I mean, we had this great extermination, not the last extermination by any means, of the Jews. And people watched them be rounded up and taken to death. They watched them. They watched them take their belongings and be rounded up, city after city, house after house. And very few intervened. And there you have it, is people are afraid to intervene when perhaps that could have been stopped. I often think this, any brutality can be stopped early enough. If you let it go on and you don't stand up, silence is a great buying in to that which is wrong. It supports unfairness. It supports inequality. It supports brutality if you're silent. And yet people are silent every day. They're silent because they're afraid it's going to take their time. It's going to change their life. And you know what? They're right. They're absolutely right. It is going to change their life. It is going to take their time. It's going to make them rethink every single thing in their life that they thought was good is actually built on maybe brutality.
Right, so how do we motivate people to intervene? And I don't mean like some big social program or major political program. I'm talking about just everyday people on the street. You're trying to do a good thing, trying to be a good person, and you start to realize that a lot is going wrong. You know, you're not a person of great power. You're not a president. You're not a leading intellectual. You're a regular person on the street, and you see violence. You see injustice towards another human being or an animal, or towards the earth. How do you get yourself involved? And I've noticed this, Nazarita, that many people they don't know the starting point. They have a really hard time figuring out what to do. And I do think they're afraid. I think they're afraid to go too far. I think they're afraid that they're going to upset the cart. And I think you really put your finger on the core of it, is that we change requires us to change ourselves. And I think there are a lot of people with major inertia. I mean, don't you think that they build this life? They're in their 30s, 40s, 50s. If maybe some of them work hard, and now all of a sudden they have an established life. They've got a routine. Things are moving, and they think to themselves, "I've got to do something, right? I've got to do something in my neighborhood." And then they start thinking, "Well, but that's going to change everything. To change everything." How do you have that dialogue with somebody, Nazarita, that assuages them and says, "Look, it's going to be okay. Yeah, your life's going to change, but that's actually okay." How do we do that? How do you have that conversation with somebody?
Well, I think it's a reciprocal dialogue. I think that when people see people involved, they begin to feel like maybe they should be involved in a certain way. So I always think it's good to invite people into, a dialogue about that. What can they do? What do they want to do? You know, what are they good at? What can they do? Like, we've seen marches everywhere. I have just seen a news report where, for George Floyd, there was one young boy holding up a sign walking through his neighborhood. He was the only one. And they took a video of him, and it was like, it takes one person before others say, well, maybe it's okay for me to act. You can't make people act, but you can inspire them to act, because the goal is greater freedom. And what is freedom, right? What is freedom?
Are you talking about teaching virtue?
I don't look on it as teaching virtue. I look on it as instead being virtue, being that which you want to. You are what you teach. You are. You can say all the fine words that you want, but if you are not that, then people are going to look at that and say, well, if you're not doing it, why would I follow what you say? Of course, there's always people, you know, who are sparked by words, and I am. I'm sometimes sparked by things that people say, and maybe those people are not the epitome of virtue or what they're trying to impart, but it's inspiring. I think there's room for everything. Why limit it to one little part? Like we should be what we want to inspire others to be. Like, I'm vegan because I think eating meat is the downfall of not only our health, but the world. And so
I am
that.
So you're suggesting that we can teach by example.
Well, that's one way, right? And remember that old saying, you pretend to be what you want to be until you are. And that's part of it, right? It's like, if you want to be something, you practice it. You practice it time after time to become that. Like, sure,
okay.
you might not do it right the first time, but there's always a second chance.
Okay, so let's go into it a step further, a little bit harder. So I can really get how a person can lead by example. I see how that works. Let's, however, look on the other side and take a person whose self-structure is anxious, fearful, complacent, compliant, self-deceptive. We have 80% of them in this country. They work for governmental organizations, mid-management, corporations, organizations, and they get a W-2 paycheck. And they save a little bit of money. They go on a vacation or two. You know what I'm saying? And they buy into the whole consumerist commodification of America. That's what they do. That is exactly what they are. And all their friends are like that. All their neighbors are like that. Most of their family members are like that. So how does that person even have the ability to see the potential for change? That's what I'm getting at. If you could address that would be really great for our listeners.
I'm going to say something that many people will not agree with. Who cares? Who cares? Who wants to spend their precious time trying to convince somebody that doesn't want to be convinced? Who cares? Unite with people of like minds, create a movement, because I'm going to tell you the majority of people who hate things that are going on that they don't want to support, and they're refusing to see what is ethical and what is right and what is solidarity. I'll tell you what, they'll hate you, they'll ridicule you, and then they'll join you. But if you spend all your time to convince somebody, you're wasting your time.
Okay, so I'm asking this. That's great. Now I want you to look for our listeners and readers to the other side of it. Not the activist. Not the person who's awake. Not the person who knows. I'm talking about the 80%, the hoi polloi, the great unwashed, the people who like to keep the peace, the people who are cogs in a process, a wheel, a system, a worldview, and a life world. That is a certain way that needs a whole lot of help. How do those people, that 80%, let's just from their point of view, like if we were living in their house on their manicured lawns, how do they begin to think about these things? How could they find a happiness in their soul? Could you speak to that person?
I'm just going to say, who cares? I mean, seriously,
okay.
If you really look at it, it's like, why are we fixated on trying to change people? Instead, if we become that and join with like-minded, I'll give you a good example. There were a lot of people who believed lawns were the way to go. Well, take a trivial little way of looking at things. Watering your lawn, using all the water, putting pesticides, herbicides, insecticides on your lawn, making them bright and green and edged and everything. And then there came a movement. Someone didn't knock on everybody's door and all those people who had these perfect lawns and say, hey, have you tried to do a more natural way? No. What they did was they created their own lawns of a natural plants, indigenous plants that were good for their, and people began to look at it and say, wow. And then they shared. They said, yeah, my water bill is like $10 a month. And they're thinking, wow, mine's $800. And they're thinking, wow, maybe that's not such a bad idea. Maybe I'll try something in the backyard. And then they talk to them. That's how change happens. Change happens. It isn't trying to convince people who don't want to be convinced or who are in total ignorance. Those people in total ignorance, and I can say I have been in total ignorance about many things. But if somebody tries to convince me to do otherwise, you better believe I'm not going to be convinced. But I'm going to tell you, once I see it in action, I think to myself, wow, I want to do that. And I change. Now, there are many people like that. So instead, let's change. Like, let's change. Like, there's a movement to defund the police. Do you think that was very popular about 5 years ago? Nope, it wasn't. But now is the time. Now is the time. There's so much brutality. Someone said, we should change the way we fund the police. and while teachers are being paid shit, and all these educational people are being paid nothing, poor neighborhoods and that don't have any food and don't have correct streets or place to live, and we're funding the police to be, have brutality. So somebody suggested that, and it took off. They didn't try to convince someone to do it. They said, this is why. They put it out there, and it was picked up because people saw the connection. I think that that's what happens. You start this smoke, and it becomes a fire.
Yep, that's great. So let's shift gears just a little bit and talk on the other side of things with the beauty of nature, the absolute beauty of nature. There are so many people who are so right now ensconced in civil unrest, which is not a bad thing, but I think a lot of people are missing this really important element of the dialectic, which is the absolute beauty of nature and how important it is to let ourselves, you know, step back from time to time from our struggles and go to a park, go to a body of water, go to a river, a lake, go to a pond, take a drive out in the country. Just to take a drive out of town into the country is a completely different self-experience than to be at a job, in a classroom, excuse me. So I like the idea of leading by example. And I think what happens is that people who are part of this giant complacent group, eventually they see others leading by example. And I've talked to them before. And they will express a great admiration for the activist. They'll basically say in so many words, I wish I had that courage. And it's the same kind of conversation about the beauty of nature. I wish I had more time to love nature. I wish I had more time to protect animals, to protect clean water. And so there's a little bit of a spark, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. There's a spark deep down in all of us that knows. And that would be my argumentative position, is that self-deception means that you know the truth. And so all the complacent are hiding. They're hiding a falsehood. They're hiding a lie. Molière points this out in his plays. What is the lie that's being hidden in the bourgeoisie? And what is the lie that we're telling ourselves about nature? And I see them as important companions for part of the very same discussion. But finding an anchor point. So if I am one of these complacent people, that I'm in this population, how do I treat nature analogous? What do you think on that? If I allow great violence in the human sphere, don't I usually just allow that in the natural domain too?
You know, I do think that they are intertwined. They're intertwined, they're interwoven, and that's the great wake-up call for humanity as a species to say, wow, you know what, we're not really alone. We think we're alone, and we've taught that we are exempt from everything except for humanness, but I think that more and more people are waking up through fighting brutality to say, well, you know, here we are, we're digging copper mines that are destroying the earth and people around them, and yet we're against brutality. And so, of course, the natural connection is such. We're destroying huge populations of animals everywhere. Species are being annihilated. For instance, just eating meat, right? I mean, let's really wake up to the fact of what humans are doing. It isn't just destroying nature. We're eating nature. And so it presents this picture of an obese human race voraciously eating everything in its path.
Yeah, yeah.
Disseminating
right.
all animals.
Right, right. And we know from the medical science that eating meat and dairy is not good for you. And that's the bottom line. I'm not going to defend it right here in this moment. I've defended it elsewhere. It's a fact. And yet people will keep on doing it. And not only is it bad for your health, it is a moral catastrophe. It's an absolute moral catastrophe to take any animal and to kill it and eat it. It is wrong. It is morally wrong. And you know what, Nazarita, maybe 100 or 200 years from now, people are going to wake up and see that, and they're going to stop killing other beings. They're going to stop killing other beings. I'll tell you, it would be a great joke on us. Superior being came to Earth who was stronger and smarter and who decided that they wanted to lock us up and eat us and make us perform for their pleasure and exploit us in every single way. That would be the great natural justice that would be done to us. Can you imagine roasting human beings, putting them in water, boiling them to death? It's gross to most people, but that's what we do to the other. So there's an illogic. It's a self-refuting life principle. We don't, but here again, as we keep saying, there's a complacency that includes a self-deception in its core, that this is somehow okay, that we have to be polite to family and friends who are having a barbecue. It is wrong. And so what makes a person stand up and say, nope, I'm not going to join your barbecue if we're going to roast the products of violence, rotting carcasses of beings who had families and intention and a life. We took that away. We need to stand up. And so I don't think we're solving the complacency issue today, but I think it's important to discuss it. We've got a minute or so left. Did you want to make some final comments before we close?
That's really interesting. I think I just want to say that we aren't going to solve complacency today, because complacency comes from fear and ignorance and apathy. And so, you know, how do you become not apathetic? And how do you fan the flame of wanting to know, wanting to see, wanting to hear that which is the other, that which is where we live, that is interconnected to us? I think that's it. I think that we pursue that knowledge, that we emulate that knowledge, that we live that knowledge.
Great. Thank you for being on the show today. I know this was a shorter conversation today, but we carry it forward. We move it forward. The title of our show today is The General State of Things, Part 3. We'll continue on next week as we find our way to a new focus topic. So feel free to email us in, Kevin Boileau. That would be kbradref@gmail.com. Or contact us through any of our websites. Send your comments, suggestions. If you want to be on the show, if you want to be interviewed, please let us know. We're happy to do so. We've enjoyed interviewing all the people that we've interviewed over the last 7 years. It's been a pleasure. There's much more to talk about. Thank you, Nazarita Goldhammer, for being on the show. Thanks to myself. We are sponsored by the EPIS Psychoanalytic Institute and Society, and we will continue moving forward in our show. And don't forget to buy the books. They're on Amazon.com. Bye-bye.